Hello and welcome to Hindsight on RN Summer. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, an unusual take on our convict history. It seems that Australian penal colonies were much more ethnically diverse than we first thought. Because the British Empire was so vast, people from the West Indies, Canada, China, Egypt, India, the list goes on, all ended up here as prisoners. And it turns out that dozens of Aboriginal Australian, Maori and Khoisan people were swept up along the way. The practice of transporting troublesome natives began in the very early days of the colony and was maintained right up until the late 1860s. By today's standards, we might see these Aboriginal transportees as political prisoners. Most were captured in the course of waging war against the frontier, but their actions were criminalised. Most Indigenous convicts didn't survive the harsh conditions of prisons like Norfolk Island. They'd been tried and convicted in courts, even though their pagan natures meant they could not swear on a Bible or give evidence. The work of one historian has brought these fascinating stories to light. We're about to meet Kristen Harmon, and she's going to tell us the stories of three of those convicts, the Gamaragal man Mosquito from Sydney, the Maori Hohepa Te Umaroa from Whanganui, and Khoisan leader David Sturman from the Cape in South Africa.
Kei roare toko toia me tau dinana e hoa hohepa te umuroa.
Hi, I'm Kristen Harmon. I'm a lecturer at the University of Tasmania and a historian. Quite a few years ago when I first came to Tasmania, I went to a little island just off the east coast here, Maria Island, and in an old colonial cemetery saw a headstone. And this headstone was the memorial of Hohepa Te Umaroa. And what struck me as remarkable is this headstone dated back to the 1840s. And it really made me wonder, what was a Maori man doing at Maraa Island at that time? I later found out, of course, that he was one of a group of Maori who had been transported to Van Diemen's Land. And that piqued my curiosity about whether there had in fact been Australian Aboriginal people caught up in the convict system and perhaps Indigenous people from other parts of the British Empire. When I looked into it, I was really astounded because page after page of the colonial record revealed more and more Indigenous convicts. To give you some figures, there were about 90 from New South Wales, 34 at least from the Cape Colony, that's now part of South Africa, and at least 6 from New Zealand. And for these particular people, and they're almost all men, only one woman, they have extensive convict records which tell me things about what they had been transported for, what they actually looked like, where they'd come from, their age, and a whole lot of other information about them. Some newspapers recorded the events leading up to their capture as well as their trials. Some of the official correspondence, and there's also personal letters and diaries, and some stunning portraits of several of the men. They really like to use transportation. I think obviously it reduces the strength of numbers of resistant fighters in certain regions at certain times when men are taken out of those areas. It also takes away leadership from people who were involved in resistance because it's often leaders that are being captured and later transported. And it also scared people. It was designed to scare people. And some of the colonists and colonial leaders talked about this. They thought transportation could in fact be better than hanging people, because if you hang people, their country people know what's happened to them and there's a body. But if you transport them, they vanish without trace. So there was this idea that you could frighten the compatriots into complying with colonial rule.
Mm.
I don't actually think it worked particularly well in terms of necessarily frightening people into giving up resistance. They continued to resist, but it certainly would have impacted on smaller localised groups in terms of their loss of that crucial leadership and those fighting men and the resources that those men would have brought to the groups in which they lived.
I'm Dr. Naomi Parry. I'm a research fellow at the Australian Catholic University. In about 2002 or three, I was working on an Australian Dictionary of Biography entry for a missing persons volume, and I was working on the life of a Sydney woman called Maria Locke, who was unknown. And the editors said to me, "Well, you're Tasmanian. Would you like to have a go at Mosquito?" And I didn't know anything about Mosquito. I just knew him. I knew that he was hanged in Hobart in 1825. I didn't know anything else. So I started looking and found a lot more than I had bargained for. In terms of how he is in the colonial record, he's unusually present. We can know quite a lot about his life, certainly from his young adulthood until his death, which I assume occurred sometime around the time he was 40. So I'm tipping he was born about 1785. And what's remarkable about him is that for a colonial Aborigine, he's recorded as speaking quite a lot into the historical record, both by his actions and by his words, some of which may or may not have been words he actually uttered. The first we hear of Mosquito is in May 1805, when a group of Aborigines were raiding settlers on the banks of the Hawkesbury. The Hawkesbury was some of the best land in Sydney and were sort of off limits to settlers because of the extremely vigorous opposition of Aboriginal people in the area. And those people were namely the Darug, but because of the forces of colonisation, people from other areas of Sydney had been pushed into that kind of last bastion. Mosquito was a Gammeragal man. He was from Broken Bay, and the first we sort of ever see him in the record is when a party of soldiers see him in the bush, and he declares in good English his determination to continue his rapacities. And he's described then as bush mosquito.
Like other men in New South Wales and those that were further inland as well, he quite quickly grasped the notion that economic sabotage was a really useful way to fight against this incursion onto Aboriginal lands. And so he was involved, for example, in setting fire to farmers' hay ricks, whereas sometimes crops would be taken just before they were ripe, or in some instances further inland, you know, 1,000 or more head of cattle driven off the land, or large flock of sheep driven away. So it wasn't just because people obviously wanted a steak or a lamb chop. They would have only taken one or two animals. It was so they would actually take away the entire herd and therefore destroy the livelihood of the colonists involved and hopefully drive them from the land.
At first, Governor King thinks that the Aborigines are raiding because they're hungry, so he orders the settlers to give them food. But it soon becomes quite clear that they have rather severe intentions towards the settlers, and he despairs and orders that the promulgators of the violence be rounded up. And it appears that the Darug hand him over as part of the price of peace. They declare that Mosquito was the chief protagonist of the outrages and surrender him. I suspect that there's some attempt at deflection, deflecting the blame from Pemulwuy and Tedbury, and that Mosquito and another Aboriginal man called Bulldog essentially get traded out. King's response at this time was really interesting, and it's very important to point out that Mosquito was never actually convicted, and he wasn't a convict. King felt very upset that the Aborigines had killed four settlers, but he was also capable of apprehending that the settlers had killed six Aborigines. And he had some sympathy for their fears about losing their land, the loss of their yam beds, those sorts of things that were understood by 1805 to be significant to Aboriginal people. So he called for a legal opinion, And Judge Advocate Richard Atkins advised him that the Aborigines were not bound by any moral or religious tie and could not give evidence or bear charging. And this was what lay behind King's decision to exile them rather than try them in any way, shape or form. So they were sent to Norfolk, and that was the end of it as far as the residents of Windsor were concerned.
To Acting Commandant John Piper, the two natives, Bulldog and Mosquito, who have been given up by other natives in their late outrages, are to be sent to Norfolk Island, where they are to be kept, and if they can be brought to labour, will earn their food. But they must not be left to starve for want of sustenance. They are to be victualled from the stores. Governor Philip Gidley King, 8th of August, 1805.
Look, I think Mosquito was a remarkably adaptable man. He had a life in which he had to adapt to various challenges and changes throughout, and he did that extremely well. He went from engaging in really what amounted to economic sabotage at the early frontier around Sydney to then having to deal with surviving the convict system at Norfolk Island, which was notoriously harsh. He was given a role as assistant to the convict charcoal burners. Being a charcoal burner, I should add, was the absolute lowest of low, really, of the roles, and then to be an assistant to one. He then was shipped to Van Diemen's Land, where it seems he was initially at least assigned to settlers as a convict servant, but later became a free person.
Norfolk became unviable as a settlement. It was too hard and too small to try and sort of make a living. It's shipping there is impossible. So they decided that they would bring everyone off and did so in stages. And Mosquito, I think, might have been the second last boat out of there, which was the Minstrel 2. And he arrived in Van Diemen's Land in 1813. So he arrives in Port Dalrymple, which is a nascent settlement in, it's now Launceston, and the place is overrun by people who are called freebooters and also later became called bushrangers. And they were escaped convicts and essentially feral convicts who really did cause an awful lot of problems in all across Tasmania at that time. And he became known for his work in tracking them and rounding them up. So we have this sort of sense of him, strong sense of him, that he's entirely willing to live by white rules and participate in white society. So I sort of see him at this time as being quite calm and measured and reasonable. And it's at this time that his brother, Philip, writes to Macquarie in Sydney, or approaches Macquarie in Sydney, and asks if Mosquito can be sent home. And Macquarie does write to the governor of Tasmania and says, could he please be sent home? But nothing happens.
He was clearly a talented tracker and was of value to the colonists in that role. That's one of the possible reasons why he was not sent back to New South Wales, whereas other Aboriginal convicts who managed to survive, very few did, were in fact sent back up to Sydney and then on to their various countries.
And a final kind of story about his tracking exploits, which again is reported by Lieutenant Governor Sorrell, that Mosquito and this convict McGill were involved in tracking down the feared bushranger Michael Howe. It's mentioned as a noteworthy, as a reason why Mosquito should be sent home. But again, he isn't. There seems to have been a series of promises made that were broken. And I really do think that he just walks into the bush at this point. And we don't hear from him again for some years, maybe 5 years, before he's actually appears again in the record.
A party of the natives arrived. Their number was about 65. Some of them had spears and sticks. I asked Mosquito where he was going, and he said to Oyster Bay. He then begged for some provision, and I told him to follow me into the hut where he could have some bread and meat. After he'd eaten some, I inquired how many natives were with him. He answered he could not tell. I then asked him if they would kill any of the sheep. He said no. Soon afterwards, he retired for that night.
In November 1823, a group of, two stockkeepers, one of whom was a convict stockkeeper, they had a new hut, and it was near what's now Swansea in Grindstone Bay. And they seem to have happened upon a sort of hunting ground for the Oyster Bay mob. And they're joined by another stockkeeper who's on his way up the coast but has a sore leg, so stops over at their hut. And their names are John Radford, William Holyoake, and Mamoa. And Mamoa is a Tahitian.
On the following morning, he again came to the hut and brought two or three women. Some of the blacks were on the opposite side of the creek. He asked for and had some breakfast with me. He lingered with the party about the plains until about 2 or 3 o'clock, and then he went away to hunt. In the evening he returned and I gave him some supper. This was Friday night. In the hut hung a small fowling piece and a musket, the one by the bed and the other over it. Mosquito handled the musket.
They don't seem to be comfortable with each other. The impression that you get from Radford's later account, which he gives to the Supreme Court, is that perhaps Mosquito made slight nuisance of himself, and certainly some people think that that the stockkeepers may have made a nuisance of themselves with the women that were taken to the hut.
Early Saturday morning, the blacks were in the sheep yard sitting around a fire at their breakfast. This was about 5:30. At 6 they came into the hut with the prisoners at the bar. These men, Your Honour, Mosquito and Blackjack. Some of the natives still remain there near the stockyard, might be 150 yards from the hut. I walked out to look at them after Mamoa. At this time, Mosquito was on the opposite side of the creek with a number of blacks who were armed, but he had no spear. The weapons he had were a waddy and a stick shaped like the axe of a tomahawk.
Nobody's at all clear what happened, but one morning the Aborigines approached the hut and managed to, while the men are outside the hut, they managed to steal their weapons, and Mosquito is not armed, but he walks up and takes their dogs away despite the fact that Mamoa begs him to leave them with the dogs. And the stockkeepers look at each other and decide they've really got no choice but to run. So they do.
We accordingly did run, when one of the blacks threw a spear, which pierced my side. I at first ran 200 or 300 yards, but Holyoake couldn't keep up with me. He exclaimed, "Jack, don't leave me." I continued running until I heard him cry, "Oh my God, the black fellows have got me." He was then about 200 yards behind me. I looked back. I saw 5 or 6 spears sticking into him. I recommenced my flight and some of them still pursued me. Eventually, I was lucky enough to escape. I can swear that no provocation was given to the natives or any violence shown by me or to my knowledge by Holyoake.
He certainly makes it clear that Mosquito didn't instigate the violence. He's there, he's very present, but and he's obviously involved and is obviously in communication with the other people, but he wasn't armed and he didn't throw any spears. But despite this, he's considered to have been a murderer.
Executions. This morning, Henry McConnell for bushranging and burglary, James Bryan, Charles Ryder, Mosquito, a Sydney black, and Blackjack, a native of this colony, for murder. On this occasion, for the first time, the scaffold was erected within the jail walls, but in view of the town. The Reverend William Bedford addressed the assembled spectators in words to the effect, "My dear friends, it is the anxious wish of these our dying fellow sinners that I should thus in public acknowledge for them the justice of their condemnation, and that I should call upon you to repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. They implore you to take warning from their ignominious end. They entreat in this their last hour that you will turn from the error of your ways to the Lord your God, for he will have mercy." This address proved very affecting, and the hapless offenders, after a short interval, were launched into eternity. Hobart Town Gazette, 1825.
I think it definitely served two purposes. It downplayed the scale of resistance, because there could be large conflicts involving even up to several hundred Aboriginal men, but then only a small portion of those may actually be captured, then arrested, and then they're put through court trials in much smaller groups. So it looks as though you've got handfuls of criminals rather than a large armed force of resistors engaged in warfare. The other key purpose it served, I think, is more of a legal one and perhaps a moral one, and that is by casting Aboriginal men as criminals and not as political prisoners or resistors, is very much in keeping with the narrative that the British came and simply settled Australia, and that the land was reasonably empty, that Aboriginal people weren't numerous, weren't really using the land, and weren't objecting to that kind of British incursion into their lands.
The only tribe who have done any mischief were corrupted by Mosquito, who, with much perverted cunning, taught them a portion of his own villainy and incited them time after time to join in his delinquencies. Hobart Town Gazette, 1825.
In a state of warfare, war propaganda arises, and I think that's happened in relation to Mosquito. If we make up stories about our martial enemies that cast them as being brutal, savage, and really less than human, it then becomes probably, in a way, easier to seek, attack, and destroy the enemy.
I believe that in his life, there's a lot to tell about broader stories of Aboriginal attempts to come to terms with civilization, and it's very rare to get a strong sense of someone's character at the time, of anyone's character, let alone an Aboriginal man living on the edges of frontier society.
You're listening to Hindsight on RN, and I'm Lorena Allam. Mosquito was one of dozens of Aboriginal people from here and overseas who were transported. At least 34 Khoi men from the Cape Colony in South Africa ended up as convicts in Sydney. The most prominent of these is a remarkable man called David Sturman. He left a very light trace on the colonial record, but historian Kristen Harmon has managed to piece his story together.
He was a leader of Khoi people at the Cape, and his brother had managed to negotiate and to obtain a tract of land. And this was kind of happening when the Dutch and the English had the Cape Colony bouncing backwards and forwards between them. And they were the last of the Khoi, the last of the indigenous people from the Cape, to live on their own freehold land where they had built a kraal or a village. But what happened then was that the British were at war with the Xhosa. And quite a few of the Khoi, who were never actually enslaved but were working as indentured servants, were fleeing across the border to join the neighbouring Xhosa against the British. And suspicions fell on David Sturman and his people that they too could well be supporting the Xhosa. Now, as a result, the British rode into the kraal and arrested David, one of his brothers, and two other men, and took them and families to Cape Town. Now, three of his wives, three of Sturman's wives and seven of the children were taken and jailed with him. And sadly, four of the children actually died in jail in Cape Town. He was sent over to Robben Island and with a group of men escaped. He actually managed to escape twice from Robben Island, which is quite remarkable, and lived for about 10 years with the COSA before he was in fact then transported out to New South Wales, to Sydney. The record's reasonably sparse, but the 1825 muster records for New South Wales show that he was in fact put to work as part of one of the government convict gangs working on constructing public works in Sydney. And he also at one point was certainly living in Hyde Park Barracks. It was actually quite a poignant and tragic story because his family never gave up hope. They fought for his return, and they actually got a lot of support from the New South Wales Attorney General, Sax Bannister.
The blame and the shame of this degradation lie heavy with some of the former possessors of this land, who, first having robbed the Aborigines of their paternal inheritance, took advantage of their tame and defenceless state to thrust them down into the most abject servitude. The case of the Sturman family, who at length lost the land settled upon them by the last Dutch governor, is a grievous illustration of this remark. The British functionary who prosecuted the head of the family is said to have himself obtained it and to have held the children in abject servitude, whilst David Sturman is pining, if alive, in New South Wales. A petition is presented to the present governor by the children, praying that their father may be restored to his home. His Majesty will find this case as much deserving mercy. New South Wales Attorney General, Sax Bannister, London, 1830.
And finally, the British agreed that he, in fact, could be sent back to the Cape, but by the time the news reached Sydney, he'd died.
Now, Khoisan chiefs from the Eastern Cape are teaming up with the National Heritage Council to begin the legal process to repatriate his remains.
We assume he was probably buried, although sometimes the remains of convicts were subject to medical examination and experimentation, so it is a little difficult to know.
He was taken away to Cape Town and imprisoned there. Within 4 months or 5 months, about four of his children died in Cape Town, and that is still a question that haunts us. And now we as chiefs, we consider ourselves as a continuation in the modern time of his legacy as what is referred to as the last of the Khoi Khoi chiefs. And we want to respect his memory.
He could be here somewhere, and it is extraordinarily important to people in South Africa today to try and have his remains returned, if that's at all possible.
The plan is to bury Stearman's remains near the Gamtoos Valley in the Eastern Cape, where he was born in 1773.
The records, this is so early for New South Wales, the records pertaining to any possible burial just seem not to be extant, so it is a real puzzle as to exactly where he might be located.
I made a vow not to cut my hair, nor brush, nor comb my hair until the remains of David Sturman are being brought back from Australia.
We are telling our ancestor in the spirit to rise. We ask him to rise up. The time for lying in state is over. We ask him to rise so we can take him back home.
Having grown up in New Zealand, we grew up very aware of the New Zealand Wars having taken place, and that in fact was the context for their transportation. These men had been involved, as part of a much, much larger group, as was often the case, in warfare in the Hutt Valley over some contested land. And they retreated up into the hills. But as winter set in and hunger forced people out of the hills, a group were in fact arrested and subject to court-martial. And five of the men, so we have Hohepa Te Omaroa, Te Komite, Te Rahui, Matu Tikiaki and Te Waratiti, were in fact shipped over to Hobart.
Having been taken in arms and in open rebellion against the Queen's sovereign authority and government of New Zealand, aiding and assisting the rebel chief Te Rangi Hayata, and being unlawfully in possession of a firelock, the property of Her Majesty the Queen, they are to be transported as felons for the term of their natural lives.
There was actually a huge outcry. Colonists in Hobart poured down to the waterfront to see them arrive. Their clothing, was they all came in traditional dress. Their clothing appeared exotic. They were seen as being, you know, very superior. And the New Zealanders, the white New Zealanders, were seen as being atrocious in their treatment of the Māori. And this is, you know, Vandemonian colonists condemning the New Zealanders for their treatment of Indigenous people.
Their greatest offence seems to have been the defence of their country against what they conceived to be foreign aggression, and they are doubtfully implicated in a murder committed under the excitement of hostilities and in the reckless violence of warfare. Hobart Town Courier, 1846.
George Grey, the Governor of New Zealand, actually wanted them sent to Port Arthur or Norfolk Island, and he wanted them to write home, because they were in fact literate, to write home about these horrendous experiences they would have there to dissuade other Māori from resisting the colonial authorities. But in fact, they were sent instead to Maria Island after the colonists in Hobart put up, an outcry about the idea that they would be sent to these other places.
Under Dr. Imrie's attentive care, the prisoners were as comfortable as they could be rendered consistently with their situation. The loss of liberty and their expatriation are their principal sources of sorrow and regret. Colonial Times, Hobart, 1848.
But their life was quite different from that of other Indigenous convicts. If we think back to David Sturman labouring in a government gang and, you know, other Australian Aboriginal convicts doing similar sorts of work, the Māori were instead, in fact, given their own separate accommodation, which they helped build. They had an overseer who could communicate in Māori. They did tasks such as veggie gardening. They were allowed to go hunting and fishing on certain days. They did Bible study. They had quite a close and warm relationship, it would seem, with their overseer's extended family who lived with him there on Maria Island. They were only there for a couple of years, actually, really just the time it took for a ship to sail to England with a letter from the Tasmanian Lieutenant Governor asking, you know, for these men to be pardoned so he could return them to New Zealand. And again, you know, for the response to be brought back from England.
Monday, April 19th, 1847. Wet day. Hohepa complaining of pain in the side. Ordered feet in warm water and a dose of salts.
The men did exhibit signs of illness, and Hohepa actually became gravely ill and suffered from tuberculosis.
Wednesday, April 21st. Maoris employed cutting and carrying wood, except Hohepa, ordered to keep in his bed.
Like many people who are gravely ill, he appeared to rally. But then after that, he was said to have, you know, faded quite quickly and in fact then died on Maria Island.
The tears flow. They are for you, Koro, for the injustice that befell you from the hands of the people who suppressed you. Our dear one, our grand ancestor Te Umaroa, you are now returning home.
Over the years, Maria Island underwent various transformations and has been used for a whole range of purposes once it was no longer a convict probation station. And it is a place where school children are taken on group excursions or visits. And in 1985, two little girls, two sisters, Sarah and Tilly Heald, whose dad happened to be from New Zealand, were on a school trip there. And when they went home, they told their father, Chris, about having seen this headstone.
Well, I noticed the gravestone on a visit to Maria Island. It seemed rather odd that a New Zealander was buried in the graveyard. So further research uncovered a rather sad story. And following the recent return of the Crowther collection of Tasmanian Aboriginal remains, we thought it would be an appropriate gesture of goodwill to return the remains of this man to his homeland in New Zealand.
And that, of course, really triggered a process of more than 2 years of negotiations between Tasmania, Canberra and New Zealand to be able to have him repatriated, Hohepa Te Omaroa repatriated to his homeland.
Sunday, July the 31st, archaeologists prepare to exhume Hohepa's remains.
We measure the diagonals. Yeah.
An historical record suggests that Hohepa's grave had been disturbed late last century and that the headstone may have been moved. Archaeologists aren't certain if any remains they might find will be Hohepa's.
Bones we find, if we do find any, may well be of a European. So we have to distinguish, if we can, between the bones of European and Polynesian.
Tuesday, the archaeologists meticulously work their way deeper. Just after noon, a small part of a coffin is exposed.
It has some integrity at the moment, but it's very damp and crumbly. There's some clay here. It looks like this might be the top of the disturbance, if there has been disturbance, of the grave. It's quite high, just underneath the turf.
Wednesday. There's little sadness today. The Maoris enjoy joining in the dig, widening the opening to reveal more of the coffin.
Well, we're just cleaning off the top of the coffin. We've just discovered what may be deliberate markings on the top of the coffin. There appears to be an H there, maybe Hohepa.
Using a scalpel and small knife, the lid is gently prized off. The Maoris request we all leave the graveside to show respect for their koro. The time is close. Some remains are found. We are not permitted to film them. The archaeologists confirmed the Polynesian origin of the 6-foot-1 long skeletal remains of Hohepa Te Omaroa.
I felt as if something has lifted off me while I was standing there when Matthew was saying the prayers, and the wind had given us a sign. It gave me the sign that they were around.
Gave me that inspiration that the Koro is saying to me, saying to us, I am ready to go home.
Thursday, Lay weaves a ceremonial mat. She found the flax here and the casket will rest in it for its voyage home. It will be buried along with the remains.
When one has a look at the backstory behind the arrests, trials and criminalisation of these men, one can see that more often than not, there were very large groups and sometimes groups that had got together with other groups of Aboriginal people that were involved in a very concerted endeavour to drive colonists from their country. And at the time, of course, we can see how some of these men were criminalised. It was held by the courts that you couldn't have one group of British subjects at war with another group of British subjects. Aboriginal people being considered British subjects. And this has created a real problem at that time and down into the present day, where there has in fact been perhaps a level of unwillingness to go back and have a close look at that record to see what really was going on. Hohepa Te Omaroa was laid to rest in his country overlooking the Whanganui River in 1988. And in 2011, his story was told in song by the New Zealand Opera. The South African Heritage Council has been behind moves to have David Sturman's body sent home to the Cape. But as you heard Kristen say in that program, it's very difficult to know where or even if he was buried in Sydney. This program was produced by me, Lorena Allam, and sound engineering by Louis Mitchell. You're listening to Hindsight here on RN. Now the story of the great Wongal leader and ambassador to the Sydney colony, Bennelong. Bennelong has long been cast as a tragic figure, a traitor to his people, a damaged character from countless Australian histories, novels and narratives. But as more information about him and his contemporaries comes to light, Bennelong's being recast as an adventurer, a politician, a diplomat, and it seems he is still speaking to us across the centuries in words and song.
I think the character of Bennelong was always in my mind as a child, catching the ferry from Manly to Bennelong Point, and I knew the name. But to me, he was a marvellous character who hadn't been given his due, who was looked on from the historical inheritance as a kind of Uncle Tom, as a kind of collaborator, and I couldn't see it.
That's Keith Vincent Smith, historian and curator. He's been investigating Bennelong's life and his long, traumatic voyage to Britain in 1792. Bennelong was 29 and his companion Yemarawani was just 19 when they agreed to sail to England with Governor Phillip. When Bennelong finally returned to Sydney Cove, he'd been away for almost 3 years. And 18 months of the journey had been spent on board ships, either at sea or stuck in dock. Yemarawani didn't make it home. In London, the two men stayed in Mayfair as guests of Governor Phillip's friend, William Waterhouse. We know quite a bit about what the two men did while they were there. But just last year, Keith Vincent Smith discovered an amazing new detail, a song Bennelong and Yemarawani performed for their hosts. Their neighbour was a man called Edward Jones, who was a musician. He copied down the tune to the song, and here it is, performed as he wrote it for the first time since 1792.
Barabula, Barama, Mengiwe and Guna. Barabula, Barama, Mengiwe and Guna.
You can see the picture of these two Aboriginal men, the Wongal men from the south shore of the Parramatta River. They're in this Georgian townhouse. They had their clapsticks, which are described, and they're singing that song. marvellous scene, dressed in their Regency clothing as they do so. So this is definitely the first song from an Aboriginal aspect ever heard in Europe.
And notated by a musician.
And notated, and the first in which the music was written down, yes. Edward Jones later became the harpist and court musician to George the Fourth. We wouldn't know, except Edward Jones lived two doors away from William Waterhouse in Mayfair, and he wrote the music and recorded the words. There's only four words, really. Barabulla, Barama, Manjin, Wayan, Guna. Can't be translated at all, except unless you think that Bulla is two and perhaps it's a kangaroo, but I don't think it is. Anyway, Edward Jones wrote it down. It was published in 1811 in England, and there's very few copies of that book itself. I found another one recently, and naturally in Cardiff in the Welsh Library.
How was that when you found that song? You must have been over the moon.
Yeah, it's one of those few eureka moments that you have slogging away for years, reading manuscripts and tracing things.
Now, I know that it's been performed most recently, which was a very moving experience.
Yes. Clarence Slocke and Matthew Doyle made a marvellous performance at the opening of the Murray Nowy exhibition that I curated at the Mitchell Library, August to November 2010. And it knocked people's socks off. They were just enthralled because it was almost as if Bennelong and Yamawarini were there. Barabula, barama, mangini, wayanguna. Barabula, barama, mangini, wayanguna. Barabula, barama, mangini, wayanguna.
You say that we don't know what they're singing about. There's been some speculation that they're singing about their wives.
Yeah, well, they said this is a song about our lovers. But the same song, interestingly enough, was recorded by quite a few people in Sydney in manuscript. Dawes has it written down just with a P instead of a B throughout the text. Collins has got the two words, two sentences reversed. And each time it was given, it was said to be a song about ancestors or a song about leaping porpoises. So it's quite possible.
That could be both.
Yeah, song men, yes, that could be both because ancestors sometimes thought to be porpoises, especially down in Dharawal country. Mm. But songs travel. Songs could be ancient. Songs could have come from inland areas, different languages from hundreds of kilometres away. So it's people like Jeremy Steele, who's an expert in the Sydney language, have not been able to make a translation.
Back at the Governor's house in Sydney Cove, Bennelong wrote a letter to his host, Lord Sydney. We're not sure if Bennelong dictated it to another person or wrote it in his own hand, because the original letter can't be found. Only a copy survives. Captain John Hunter carried the letter with him to England, but nobody knows where it went or even if Lord Sydney ever received it. Keith Vincent Smith believes the copy of the letter we have today comes from an obscure German astronomy journal published at the start of the 1800s. He's found out more about Bennelong's letter and its own long journey across the globe.
The provenance of the letter itself is very interesting. In the National Library, there's a handwritten copy, and this has been the only one known to us for some time, but poking around recently, I found that both the Mitchell Library and IATSIS, the Institute of Aboriginal Studies in Canberra, have copies of a German book published in 1801 in Graz, and here's the Bennelong letter. And if you look at it carefully, it's obvious that that copy as copied from this printed version. So also we can say then, not only is this the first letter written by an Aboriginal person, but certainly the first printed letter and the first in Europe in this 1801 monthly statement by an astronomer called Baron Franz Xavier von Zach. And how did it get there? That's also interesting, because John Hunter was the courier.
Sir, I am very well. I hope you are very well. I live at the governor's. I have everyday dinner there. I have not my wife. Another black man took her away. We have had Murray doings. He speared me in the back. But I better now. His name is Garraway. All my friends alive and well. Not me. Go to England no more. I am home now. I hope, sir, you send me anything you please. Hope all well in England. I hope Mrs. Philip very well. You nurse me, madam, when I'm sick. You're very good, madam. Thank you, madam. And hope you remember me, madam, not forget.
John Hunter took the letter. He talked to Banks. Banks sent the letter to Göttingen, where Blumenbach, the anatomist, the man who coined the word Caucasian, lived, and he sent it on to the astronomer, who published the letter then in his monthly journal, which was a kind of magazine that plotted the stars and gave readings of for various ports around the world. So very valuable piece of publication in those days.
What was the context for the publication in this German journal?
Don't know. It's quite different than most of the things in the journal. There it has had reports previously of Cook going to Botany Bay, that you know, voyages in general, and telling the coordinates of those ports. So I guess that's the sort of context of it. But it was a curiosity, I would say. Blumenbach had been sent heads of Port Jackson men, probably one by Philip and probably one by Hunter.
Madam, I want stockings. Thank you, madam. Send me 2 pair stockings. Sir, you give my duty to Lord Sydney. Thank you. Very good, my lord. Hope very well, all family. Sir, please send me some handkerchiefs for pocket. You please, sir. You send me some shoes? 2 pair. You please, sir. Bennelong, 1796.
Bennelong's letter to Lord Sydney, as read by RN's Rico Ardron. And that excerpt from the program Bennelong Sings you can find on our website. Just look for Hindsight in the drop-down box at RN Online. Hindsight's back on your radio next Sunday at 1 here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. I'll talk to you then.